Today is Monday, January 30th. We're going to finish up sale information today. Okay, so we're taking a look at the nucleus on page 29. I just want to remind you about the nucleus structure. You may recall the nucleus has an outer membrane. It's called the nuclear envelope or nuclear membrane. And it's got a bunch of holes and pores all scattered throughout it. So what's the purpose of having pores on your protective membrane? Yeah, let stuff come and go, right? Let stuff come into the nucleus, let items leave the nucleus. So it's largely a communication issue. You got to let the holes be there so stuff can come and go from the nucleus. If you had to describe the number one job of your nucleus, it would be what? Yeah, control center, right? It's like the brain or control center. So if you lock up your control center and you don't allow communication with it, then you have a really hard time knowing what you're supposed to do. So think of it in those terms, that those pores or holes are there in order for communication to occur. You've kind of got a hot spot for the communicative process, and it's the nucleolus. That dark spot inside the nucleus is where a bunch of the proteins and DNA hang out. I kind of refer to it as the party spot within the nucleus. That's where you're going to find most of those proteins and DNA. Now, when a cell is not replicating, we see the DNA hanging out in a relaxed state. We call that relaxed state chromatin. So I kind of think of it as unraveled yarn. It has structure to it, but to the naked eye, this looks like just an unraveled mess. Now, if we were to look very closely, we would see that those strands are actually wound together. In fact, how many strands make up your typical DNA?
Two.
Two, good. And so what are the four base pairs that you find here? Good, A, T, C, and G, right? Okay, so, and those hydrogen bonds link those two strands together, but when you're in an unreproductive state, this is how DNA looks. It's just an unraveled yarn state. There are two strands making up the DNA, but the DNA basically has no real, it's not really an organized look to it. Okay, so let's talk about how DNA might look if you were going through, say, cell reproductive processes. When you go through cell reproduction, it's easier to reproduce and copy a chromosome into something that looks like an airplane propeller or a butterfly. It's much harder to copy something when it's in its unorganized state. So the point I want to make is DNA in the nucleus can take on a relaxed state that we call chromatin, which looks like unraveled yarn, or it can take on a much more refined, structured look, which is what we call a chromosome. So chromosomes and chromatin are both made up of DNA. It just happens to be two different ways to structure it. Okay, so just two different ways to structure your DNA. In fact, there's even a third way that we can structure it. And let's talk about that. First of all, these are both chromosomes, right? Okay, this is DNA and it's unraveled, relaxed state called chromatin. Sometimes when the cell is getting ready to divide, it gets dressed up all nice and pretty. This is called a chromosome. Because there's one arm on top and one on the bottom, it's called a single-stranded chromosome. Guess what this one's called?
Double-stranded.
Good, because there's two arms on top and there's two arms on the bottom. Each arm is called a chromatid, okay? And so there's actually just a single chromatid on the top and a single chromatid on the bottom in the single-stranded chromosome. And there's a pair of chromatids on the top and a pair on the bottom in this double-stranded chromosome. Now the catch is, this double-stranded chromosome in fact has copies. The top arm is a copy of each other, and the bottom arms are also identical copies of each other. So when we go through cell reproduction or cell division, we actually divide this chromosome in half right there at the dot in the center. So what we end up with are in fact single-stranded chromosomes in each of our new cells. So the point I want to make is that chromatin and chromosomes are all made up of DNA. It's just different ways to look at it. Okay, it depends on if you're doing reproduction or if your cell's just hanging out doing its daily activities. So that kind of takes me to the next step in talking about DNA and its role in the cell cycle. So what is the cell cycle?
Replication period.
it's like a life cycle, and part of the life cycle is a cell division portion called mitosis. And cell division or mitosis is a time when we divide our cells in two. So why might your body want to perform mitosis? Make new cells. Yeah, grow and repair, perhaps get rid of cells that have been worn out or damaged. So what we're going to have to do in order to prepare for mitosis is go through this big portion of the life cycle that we call interphase. You may have looked at this stuff in lab. You know, you probably looked at cells in interphase and the four phases of mitosis. What we're talking about right now is preparing for that cell division process, a portion right here called the S phase. Is the S phase an interphase, or is it in part of mitosis?
It's an interphase.
It's an interphase, right? Because all of this stuff here is in the lead up to that cell division process we call interphase. So what we're going to do during the S phase is actually prepare the cell for having a copy of its DNA. And this is not going to work because chromatin is really messy. It's kind of an unraveled state. And if I wanted to separate this, I'd have to go from the end of one of these strands and separate all the way to the other end. So that would be quite a process to do that separation. Okay? And so in order to prevent mistakes and to make a more efficient process, what we're going to do is make our DNA get together in its, you know, more replicated, more structured state of a chromosome. So that's what we're going to do right now, is actually understand how we do cell division. And by doing that, we're going to prepare our DNA for the process of being separated into two identical cells. So what we need to appreciate is the fact that DNA is made up of how many strands?
Two.
Good. And there's something called base pairing rules here that we have to mind. These base pairing rules tell us which bases like to pair with each other. Adenine, for instance, likes to pair with what other base?
Thymine,
good. And likewise, thymine pairs with adenine. That means cytosine pairs with what?
Guanine,
good. And of course, guanine pairs with cytosine. So in order to do cell replication or cell division, we actually have to replicate or copy our DNA as preparation. So the first thing you see happening here is the DNA unraveling itself and unzipping itself. In doing this, we're preparing that DNA for making copies of itself. So we know the base pairing rules. We know A's and T's. T's and A's go together. We know C's and G's. G's and C's go together. But we can't do base pairing if the DNA is all zipped up like a zipper, okay? So in order to copy that DNA in preparation for cell division or mitosis, one of the first things you got to do is unzip and separate those strands of DNA, okay? You're with me so far? Okay. Well, so that's what we're doing here. We're actually preparing that DNA for its copying process. Replicate means to copy. And the next thing we have to do is bring in our copies of the base pairs. See how we separated it up here near the top? And then down here near the bottom, we're already doing the base pair copying. So you know the rules, C's and G's pair, T's and A's pair. And it looks like we're doing just that as we bring in a new backbone to build a new double strand of DNA. Okay, so what I'd like to do is do this with you. And we're going to use the bottom of the page as one of our practice pages. Okay, so what I need to do first of all is take my double strand of DNA and separate it. So I'm going to make those two strands separate, and now I can make a copy of each strand. Each old strand is called a parent strand or a template strand. And that's what we're going to use to build our new copy from, is that parent or template strand. Here is I've taken your two parent strands, I bubbled them apart, I separated them, just like unzipping a zipper. What our goal right now is to copy the DNA so we have a set for our old cell to keep when we go through mitosis. What happens to the other set of DNA? Yeah, one goes with the old cell, one set goes with the new cell, okay? So, first thing you want to appreciate is this. Do these old nucleotides, do they look like they paired up correctly?
Yes.
They look like they did, okay? And so, that's going to serve as a built-in self-check because our goal here is to replicate or copy our DNA so each cell can get an exactly identical copy. All we have to do is behave like an enzyme. We're going to do the base pairing rules. So let's take the top strand first. What should base pair with thymine?
Adenine.
Adenine, good. And of course, thymine pairs with adenine. What comes next?
Cytosine.
Guanine. Good, adenine. Okay, good. Feel foolish doing that, don't you? Rebecca.
So, I think we
these haven't bubbled.
How did you get it so long?
Well, these haven't bubbled yet, and so what I was doing is these are going to separate eventually, but what I did was I opened up the strand, so I now had room for the daughter strand to be written inside, and this is how every chromosome of ours gets copied. So in terms of length there, I'm not sure I follow the question.
You wonder how does she know?
How did you get T A G C C T A G?
I made it up.
Oh, okay.
I was trying
to get that top, the blue one, out of that.
Oh no, this is just a continuation.
I just
bubbled it open right there.
So this is like the
here. But you just when you went to write the T A G C C T, you just
picked it randomly.
Okay.
Yeah, completely off the top of my head. Okay.
Oh, I see.
You found me.
I see.
So basically, as long as the T and complements are pairs with the A and vice versa all the way down, you already know what it's going to pair with. You just replicate it.
That's it.
Maybe I'll do this first.
It's that easy. So the bottom daughter strand that I'm going to write in orange is going to reflect the top old parent strand. You guys know the routine, right? T A
G C T A G G C A.
Okay. Okay. So what I end up with in blue is our parent template strand that provides the backbone for my DNA. And then in orange, we've got written here the daughter strand, which is built off the parent or template strand. So we're going to eventually unzip our way toward the left, and we'll keep on copying in that direction. But if you have, say, 23 chromosomes, all of them are going to bubble open with these little blisters and start replicating instantly. So that way it takes less time and we can get it all done in a fairly short time period. Do you feel like you can make the copies on the test?
Yes.
Okay, so the base pairing rules are A's and T's, T's and A's, C's and G's, G's and C. And what the question's gonna say is perform DNA replication. And all that means is provide a copy with the complementary base pairs.
And all you're going to give us is the four, basically four letters of each, or you're actually going to have it, one of them out?
I'll give you a snapshot like that,
okay.
And I'll ask you to give me what's an orange to complement it.
Different than what it was, what I thought it was supposed to be.
It's always going to go like this one to the one beneath it. So you are going to read left to right like we normally read. The bubbling is, it's something called 5' to 3' ends. And that's not something we normally talk about in here, but it goes in opposite directions, dipping really fast, like two bullet trains. But we're going to read left to right always. Yeah.
Well, I had a question too, but it had a U.
That is not DNA replication. That is protein synthesis, which is where we're going next. Okay.
Really, really stupid question, but the parent strain of oats are not copied at all in that, the TCGA.
Right. Well, that parent strand is now that daughter's strand.
Okay. I was talking about on your left, the TCGA.
Yeah.
Doesn't look like it's like replicated or copied at all in the long strand. Is that normal?
Well, we're coming this way. We'll eventually copy this. It just hasn't been unzipped yet.
Okay. Okay. So that's okay. This is the product of, yeah. Never mind. I understand what you're saying.
This is what we've got.
So this is just a continuation of the pattern that we just finished.
Right. And eventually we're going to do this number and finish this in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was looking all for it.
Y'all with me? How about questions anywhere? Any part that I can clarify for you? So just in review, what we just did is copying DNA. What's the point of copying it?
Growing.
Right, growing, right, because when you go through mitosis, every cell needs a brain, and the brain or control center has DNA, and this is how you get extra DNA. Keep in mind, it should be a perfect copy. We shouldn't introduce mutations, which are mistakes. That's a nice way to say you made a mistake, right? So, yeah, mutations would be putting the wrong letter, so maybe putting a G instead of a T, for instance. But you know what? You've got a built-in self-check. You've got enzymes that come along and proofread behind, and they actually make sure that there are no mistakes, because once a mistake is made, it gets inherited again and again throughout your body. And if that occurs in sex cells, can even be passed along to your offspring. So yeah, we don't want to make sure that, you know, we want to make sure we don't prevent or don't include mistakes or mutations in further generations.
Where it says function on page 29, the nucleus is part of the cell that houses the
DNA. Yep. And bottom of your page, a parent strand and a daughter strand are your two blanks. So what you're looking at is called the cell's life cycle. Around 90% of your cell's life cycle is spent in interphase, which includes gap 1, S. Hey, S is replication, right? We just did the replication. And gap 2, or growth period phase. You'll notice only around 10% of your cell's life cycle is spent in a reproductive period that we call mitosis. So really, it's like a human life cycle. If a person lives 100 years and has 10 babies, that means if she's female, she was only pregnant for 10 of those 100 years. So around 10% of your cell's lifetime is spent reproducing. The rest of your cell's lifetime is spent just doing its daily activities. So what I want to focus on now is how to make proteins. And you make proteins during these G subphases. Are these gap periods part of interphase or part of mitosis?
Interphase,
right. So that's not the cell division portion. That's just living, growing, doing. That's just your cell behaving and doing its regular activities. So I need you to flip on over with me to page 30. And you'll notice that there are, in fact, two steps of making proteins. And those two steps are transcription and translation. So I need to remind you of RNA structure because it's now involved in making proteins. Can you tell me how RNA is different from DNA?
Uracil and thymine.
Uracil and thymine, 1, 2 strands.
Good. sugar.
Sugar.
Sugar, yep, that's it.
Ribose.
Good. You're right, so uracil replaces thymine in terms of those four base pairs. We know that RNA is a single strand as opposed to double strands. And the sugar here is ribose. The sugar in DNA was deoxyribose. Either way you look at it, they were five carbon sugars. We just happen to have a different sugar this time, an RNA molecule. So you say, why in the world do we need to use RNA to make proteins? Why can't we just use DNA? Well, let's look back at where the DNA is housed. DNA is stuck somewhere, right? Where's DNA stuck? So if you took the brain of your cell out of the nucleus and you let it go into the cytoplasm to make proteins, what if a virus attacked it? Then you're dead, yeah. So that's no good. So we can't take your DNA out of the nucleus. For one, it's too big to fit through the nuclear pores. And then secondly, if it's damaged, you've got a real big problem there. So what we do instead is we make a photocopy of our DNA, and that photocopy is the RNA molecule. And so if the RNA molecule gets damaged, if it gets attacked by something, no big deal. We've got the blueprint still inside of our nucleus, that blueprint being our DNA. So that's why we use a photocopy called RNA to make proteins. We don't want to bother the blueprint. Damaging it could cause death to that cell. So keep in mind, RNA is very similar, just three main differences here. The sugar is ribose, the base thymine is replaced with what?
Uracil.
And how many strands?
Just one.
Just one. Okay. So we of course know that there are two steps to making a protein. This picture is really busy, so I think what I'll do instead is just break it down for you on the board. Transcription and translation are the two steps that we need to involve to make a protein. Okay, good time to review. What are the building blocks of your typical protein? Amino acids. Amino acids are your building blocks. So ultimately that's what we're going to do. We're going to turn a strip of DNA into a strand of RNA. And that strand of RNA is going to serve as the code for our amino acids, which of course build our proteins. So let me erase this one here and we'll start with something clean looking. So here's job number one in making a protein. Job number one is to do transcription. Transcription rewrites DNA into RNA. Why RNA?
Because we can't take the DNA out, so we have to.
Good, good. You can't take the DNA out of the nucleus, so it has to stay stuck inside. So what we do is we make a photocopy, and that photocopy is RNA. Okay? So that's what we're going to do right now inside the nucleus. We're going to transcribe or rewrite DNA into RNA.
So RNA is created because we can't take DNA out.
That's right.
That's right.
So you just told me there were three differences here between DNA and RNA. The sugar is not such a big deal, but I'll tell you what is a big deal. That base. Yeah. So what base replaces thymine?
Uracil.
Uracil. Okay. So T's and A's are okay. A is A-OK to have an RNA. T is not all right. So instead of putting a T next, I replace it with
a U.
Okay. So if you find yourself getting stuck here, just know that if you look at a strand and it has T's in it, dead ringer for a DNA molecule. If you see a strand that has U's in it, that should be a flag that says, I am what?
RNA.
I'm RNA, good. C's and G's, they're real easy. Of course, no change there. So we've got a C coming up next. And then what binds with those two A's?
U's.
Got U's again. What does that T bind with?
A.
A is A-OK. Another G. And a U. Okay, so that A binds with a U.
A-OK.
A is A-OK. There you go. Okay, so what you just did was you made a copy of your DNA. Keep in mind, this time it's all unraveled in its chromatin state, and it's hanging out in the nucleus because it's not going to be able to leave. So that DNA, ooh, that's a mess, isn't it? Okay, so there's our nucleus. We just made a copy of RNA. RNA is going to leave through one of those nuclear pores. Hey, yet another good reason to have nuclear pores, right? Okay, and now RNA is going to come out here to your cytoplasm in search of a ribosome, which looks like a hamburger bun. And that ribosome is the site of what? What do ribosomes make?
Proteins.
Yeah, so that's where we're headed. This RNA strand is headed to a ribosome, and the ribosome is going to translate what the RNA says into proteins. Basically, yeah, it's kind of like the messenger that's doing the delivery service from the DNA to the ribosome. Exactly. Okay, so I think ribosomes are kind of funny looking. They look exactly like a hamburger bun. They have a top bun that's bigger, just like a hamburger bun and a smaller piece. And the mRNA that we just made is going to travel through that ribosome. And in doing so, it's going to serve as a translator. So it turns our RNA message into amino acids. So you can see that this is now the link between DNA and how we make and build a protein. By the way, there are three types of RNA molecules. The kind that carries a message or a messenger is going to be this one we just built. And the messenger or message RNA carries a code called a codon. So how many base pairs are in a codon?
Three,
yeah. So don't make the mistake of calling them condoms. I've had people tell me that on tests for years. Yeah, they're codons, and they have three base pairs. So come back to our strand of RNA, and all you gotta do is count by threes. AUG is your first codon, okay? Your next group of three, GCU, good. UAG, and UAA. So we've got a really short strand here. Only how many codons?
Four.
Four codons, good. We've just made is a specific type of RNA. It's not just any old RNA. This one's called messenger RNA. And you've heard the old story, don't shoot the messenger. I've just got the code for you. And so this particular RNA molecule carries codes in groups of three. These are triplets, and these are going to code for an amino acid. Okay, so we've actually got four codes up here, AUG, GCU, UAG, and UAA. Okay. There are, in fact, two other kinds of RNA. There's one called tRNA. What does the T stand for?
Transfer.
Good. And it transfers amino acids when we start making a protein. And then we've actually already looked at our RNA. It's the ribosome. Okay, so the ribosome is made up of our RNA. It's got the hamburger subunits, the big one on top and the small piece on the bottom. All right, so we've actually got half of our job done. What we now need to do is complete the process of making a protein. The first step is called transcription. That has to take place in the nucleus. The second step is called what?
Translation.
Good. Where does that take place?
Ribosomes.
Good. Now, you may recall ribosomes can be in two locations. Where are they?
Rough
ER. Cytoplasm. Good. Can be in one of those two locations. So I think that you and me can look at the codes here, and all I see is letters. I see A's, U's, C's, and G's. It confirms for me that we've got RNA molecules, but it doesn't tell me what we've actually got protein-wise. So we have to actually pretend that we're going to be the code readers and use a codon chart to help us do translation. You do not have to memorize the codon chart. It's always going to be provided for you, and there's one on your test, like there's one right there on the bottom of your page. So all you have to do is make sure that you divide your codes up into groups of how many?
Three.
Do the groups of three. Make sure you don't have T's in there, because look at that chart. You will not find one single T in that chart. Okay, and if you do have T's in your mRNA, you probably didn't transcribe correctly. And so now you just read. What is the codon AUG coding for?
Start.
So it says to the tRNA molecule, hey, start reading me here. So you know when you go to the grocery store or any retail store, they often have a handheld scanner and they can scan any UPC code on the back of a product? That's what we're doing right now. But instead of it being a handheld scanner, we're using what's called a tRNA molecule. T stands for transfer, but what it's actually transferring are the amino acids. So it scans and reads AUG, and it says, oh, AUG codes for start or methionine. And it goes and gets that particular amino acid, and then it starts plugging them down here in this translated string. Take a look at GCU. What does that code for? Alanine sounds good. Okay, and so you've got to read it in the right order, right? You can't flip-flop your letters. You'll get a different amino acid. What does UAG code for?
Stop.
I know this is silly, but what is it telling you to do?
Stop.
Stop reading me right here. So, in fact, the next one is another stop codon. Okay, so that's what we're looking for, is a start that tells that tRNA molecule to start scanning and reading here. It will continue reading until it reads a stop codon, and then the tRNA says, hey, you told me to stop reading, so I'll stop adding to this growing polypeptide strand. So we've got the world's smallest protein, right? It's got one amino acid there. But you know, you can have two and call it a dipeptide, or many and call it what?
Polypeptide,
right. So it just depends on what you've got in your strand there as to how many times your tRNA needs to continue reading and translating. Let me give you a helpful built-in clue. Both words transcription and translation begin with trans, but then there's a C, and then there's an L. Alphabetically, transcription comes before translation. Okay, that's one helpful hint. The next letter is an R, because transcription makes RNA. The next letter in translation is an A, because what are we making there?
Amino acids,
right. So there's a couple of built-in clues in case you get lost in the words. I use that to help me keep the two straight. So what you're going to be asked to do on the test is I'll give you a DNA strand like this one. I'll ask you to transcribe it and translate it, It's a 1.5 multiple choice question. So you can't do translation if you're using T's. You'll have to, of course, do the transcription part first. Let's practice one to make sure you're good to go. And, of course, you can jot this one down. Do use that codon chart on the bottom of your page. So the top strand, is that DNA or RNA?
DNA.
Good. How do you know?
It's
got T. It's good. So, of course, that's going to be a great clue for a DNA molecule. The rewriting from DNA into RNA, is that called transcription or translation?
Transcription.
Transcription. Good. Okay. And then how do you know the second strand is, in fact, RNA?
Use.
Good. It is my personal habit to put little lines between the groups of threes or the codons, because if not, I'll get lost in there somewhere and end up having somebody left out. But if you put the lines in there and divide yourself up, you'll at least be able to say, okay, we know AUG codes for the start. And of course, that's where the tRNA reader is supposed to start translating. The next one is proline. Is proline an example of amino acids, RNA, DNA? It's an amino acid, yeah. And so what we do is we keep translating. A piece of the RNA gives us one single amino acid. And when do we stop reading? Where it says stop. Good. Come test time on Wednesday. I'll always have you a start and a stop built in. So if you haven't done transcription or translation properly, then you'll kind of have this reminder that, oh, I don't have a start or a stop codon, so go back and double check your work.
So the RNA is always transcribed in the protein. Amino acids.
Yeah, always translated from RNA into amino acids.
Amino acids are proteins.
Amino acids are proteins, yes, good.
Good.
Would you like another one? One more? Okay. So when you're ready, the RNA and amino acids are up here for you to check. Do you feel comfortable with this? Any questions, any part that I can help clarify for you? Okay, I just want to repeat, do not memorize the codon chart. That will be on the test for you, and it's a 1.5 point multiple choice question. All you have to do is transcribe first, and then, of course, translate using the chart. I do want to remind you to look for clue words on the test. Replicate does not mean the same thing as transcribe or translate. If you're replicating, all you're doing is copying. And in that case, you keep your thymine, you don't use uracil. So make sure you see the difference that DNA replication and then transcription and translation are, in fact, three totally different processes. Okay.
Yeah, so replicate means that we write it without the E.
That's right.
Still transcribe.
The T's, well, the C's and the G's all work out, the A's and the T's, but the A's still pair with T's, not U in that case.
Whenever we replicate it, we don't do the amino acids, right?
Yeah, don't do the amino acids with replication.
So if it says replicate, you would write, the answer would be A, T, G, G, C, C, like that, or it would be T, A, C, C, G.
If you're replicating, if I give you simply that and I said replicate, then it would be A, T, C, or G, G, C, and so on. Yeah. Right. So during our last part of class today, let's talk about some membrane transport. Okay, so we're on page 35. Do take a look at the organelles, pages 31, 32. There's a picture there if you would like to label it. It's on page 33. So the term membrane transport means that we are, guess what, transporting stuff across membranes. And so we have to be reminded of the peculiar structure of the plasma membrane. We have two layers of what? Phospholipids. Yeah, two layers of phospholipids. We've got embedded proteins like these integral proteins. And then, of course, there are some surface proteins called peripheral proteins. Our big deal today is the fact that that double-layered phospholipid is a little peculiar in what it lets across. The heads that are oriented toward the outside, here and in here, are hydrophilic, meaning what? Water-loving. What about the tails that are on the inside? Good, hydrophobic, water-fearing. So it just so happens that if those tails are hydrophobic, they actually like fat molecules. So fat molecules can travel through the phospholipid bilayer. You just can't be water-based and expect to travel through that phospholipid bilayer. Something we're going to keep in mind today. Something else I want to introduce to you at the very top of your page are the two terms solvent and solute. Let me give you an example. If you make sweet tea, once you've brewed your tea and it's time to add the sugar that you're adding is going to be dissolved by your tea. So we say your sugar is your solute, and the tea is doing the dissolving, therefore it's the solvent. Okay, so we could talk about salt being dissolved in water, the same concept. The smaller volume is going to be your solute. The greater the volume is going to be your solvent. Likewise, even blood gases get transported this way in your bloodstream. If CO2 is transported by your blood plasma, is that carbon dioxide your solute or your solvent? Solute, good. And of course, the solvent is doing the dissolving, and so blood plasma actually behaves as your solvent. Okay, so on your worksheet there, carbon dioxide is your solute. The solvent is your blood plasma. It's doing the dissolving. So we're going to talk today about solute concentration, and that's how much solute you have dissolved in your solvent. We are about as salty as the ocean. That's around 3% solute concentration. So kind of interesting, the salt water tastes so extremely salty to us, but in fact we have blood fluids, blood plasmas, interstitial fluids that are about the same concentration as seawater, about 3%. We're going to talk about two kinds of transport, active and passive transport. You may want to take a moment to complete the information at the bottom of the page. And I'm not going to run my mouth. You guys can copy in silence there if you like from the bottom of your, on the bottom of your page. So while you're wrapping up that information at the bottom of the page, I do want to kind of discuss this concept of a concentration gradient. These passive transport processes go with the flow. That means from high to low concentration. There's no energy required to move you from high to low. Just like if you go to the playground, you hop on the slide, from the top of the slide to the bottom, it's basically a free ride. There's no energy required for you to go with the flow. Now, if you decide that once you've been down the slide that you're going to climb up the slide for another ride, that's work. And so when you're going against the flow, you're going to have to put ATP energy to work, and that is going against the concentration gradient. We call that an active transport process. All these active transport processes use ATP, and we know ATP is an energy molecule. So no ATP required if you're going with the flow. It's always easiest to go with the flow. Anybody still need this slide? Diffusion is probably the easiest to understand passive transport process. This process takes you from high to low concentration with no energy or ATP required, and it occurs inside your body and outside. If anybody's ever sat at the dinner table with someone else who had gas, do you understand the concept of diffusion? Okay? Or maybe you've been into a department store and walked past the perfume counter, and you can smell that for many feet beyond the perfume counter. That's the concept of diffusion. It goes from a highly concentrated area to a low concentrated area, and the goal is to spread out those particles to an even distribution. We call that equilibrium. So the goal in this picture is to get all those particles evenly spread out. That's why the perfume counter doesn't necessarily smell down the entire length of the mall, nor does someone's gas at the dinner table smell for very long. It very easily, well sometimes, it very easily diffuses out, right? Okay, I might want to make a point here at the top of your page. In your body, in order to diffuse, you have to meet one of two requirements. Notice at the top up there, you have to either have a size or a charge issue. So in other words, you have to be small or lipid. That's what you're going to want to highlight. You have to either be small, that's the third line, top of the page. You have to either be small or you have to be a lipid. If you head down about halfway of the page with me, number 4 says, what are some examples of substances that diffuse? Carbon dioxide, oxygen. You can also add another one there. Any type of fat also diffuses.
Can you repeat that?
Sure, carbon dioxide, oxygen, and any type of fat. All right, so the key points here about diffusion are that you're looking at a movement of molecules across a membrane from high concentration to low concentration. The goal is what?
Equilibrium.
Equilibrium, good. And what are the rules for those substances that can diffuse? You have to be either
small or lipids.
Yeah, you got to be tiny, small, don't want to rip holes in the plasma membrane, or you have to be a lipid because that's what satisfies those phospholipid tails. Okay. Near the bottom of your page, let me mention that two things that affect diffusion rates. One is temperature and the other is viscosity. Cooler temperatures slow diffusion rates, while warmer temperatures speed diffusion. That's why fevers can do a number on your body. The hotter you are, the more feverish you are, the faster everything works in your body. Viscosity is linked to dehydration and your blood volume, so viscosity is also an issue for diffusion rates. You'll notice here it says the more fluid the environment, the faster the diffusion. However, if you have a thicker environment, the slower the diffusion. So that means if you're dehydrated, your blood will be thicker, and diffusion occurs more slowly when your blood is thick. I know right now this doesn't like make a whole lot of sense, but when you get to Bio211, we'll bring that exact concept back up and relate it to heart rate, blood pressure, and all that good stuff. Let me skip the three lines at the bottom of the page. We've actually done them already. You copied them down on the previous page. And instead, let me take you over to osmosis. How is osmosis related to diffusion? Water diffusion. Good, good. So the catch here is, if it's like diffusion, we're moving something from high to low concentration. We're in fact moving water from high solvent to low solvent concentration. If you want to make more sense out of it, you could say we're going from low solute to high solute concentration. So what is the rule of thumb with osmosis? Water always follows what?
Salt.
So the saltiest area is going to pull the water toward it.
So
diffusion is fats and tiny stuff. Osmosis is just water. Most likely it's this, yeah.
And that word beside?
Aquaporin. Well, the aquaporin is actually a protein channel. It's an integral channel, and it's specially built just for water molecules to travel through. So you've got to have those to have osmosis equal out solute concentration. Interesting.
So where you see osmosis, you'll see aquaporins.
You'll see aquaporins, yeah, in the plasma membranes. You know, sometimes solutes can't travel across membranes. Keep in mind, in order to travel across, you got to be small or
lipid.
And if you can't travel across a membrane, you may be stuck on one side. But hey, if there's aquaporins, like we saw in the previous picture, then water can travel to help equalize solute concentrations. Water always travels to the side with more
salt.
Exactly. So what you see in this image is water traveling to the saltier side. And the whole goal here is to reach what?
Equilibrium.
Bingo, good. So we know the easy situation is isotonic solutions. And in iso, the prefix means same solute concentration. So is there any need for water to move in an isotonic solution?
No.
No. So on your worksheet there, iso equals same. That's your happy place. That we take some of your blood and we plop your blood cells into a solution. And if we put your cells in a solution that is hypotonic to the cell, we're going to watch what happens to that cell. We're going to say that your cell has around, let's just pick a number, 3% for its solute concentration. And let's put it in a solution that has less than 3%. So what number could you pick? 1.5, good. You could pick 0. The number just has to be lower than what?
3%.
Got to be lower than 3%. Keep your eye on the prize, right? The thing here is that water always moves toward your highest salt concentration. These percentages are salt concentrations. So your highest percentage is where? In the cell, yeah. So guess where water moves?
In the cell.
In the cell. Water is going to continue to enter through aquaporins and continue to enter through aquaporins until we reach what goal?
Equilibrium.
And you know, unfortunately, we may never make it because this cell may in fact bloat to the point of doing what?
Bursting.
Right. So the fancy name for that is telesis. And this is what happens if you drink a lot of fluids over a short period of time. Your brain cells and your blood cells can actually burst. So if you have trouble keeping straight that cells bloat when placed in hypotonic solutions, keep the O's together. Hypotonic means a lower solute concentration. Cells will bloat and eventually lysis left in this situation. Okay, so on your worksheet, hypo means below. And of course, we have to keep in mind the whole reason for water movement here. There's two reasons water enters this cell. One is to reach equilibrium. And secondly, because we know water always goes to the saltiest area. Thank you. So pretty much everything you drink, from milk, alcohol, soft drinks, tap water, Gatorade's isotonic, right? Okay, but pretty much everything you choose to drink is going to be hypotonic to your cells. And you have a thirst mechanism that says, I'm thirsty, drink. And then when you satisfy the mechanism, it shuts off the thirst mechanism, because this is what type of feedback loop?
Negative.
Negative, yeah. So you normally don't exceed the thirst mechanism's rule. You say, okay, I'm no longer thirsty, I stop drinking. And you prevent yourself from ever getting to the point of bloating and bursting your cells. Well, bloating is good if you're dehydrated, but under no condition do we want to burst our cells. So the flip side of the coin is the saltiest solutions, the hypertonic solutions. None of us tend to like to drink salt water. You know, nobody wants to get a mouthful of ocean water. So we think of these really salty solutions as being ones that do what to our cells? Dehydrate them, yeah. So if you have a cell in solution and the solution is saltier or more concentrated, now which way does water move? Yeah, out toward the solution. So you did tell me your cell dehydrates, it shrivels. Another fancy word is to crenate, not cremate. And if these were in fact red blood cells, they would look somewhat spiky in appearance because of the amount of fluids that they would lose. So at the bottom of your page, hyper means what?
Above.
Above, good. And the same two reasons. Water's going to leave your cells to reach equilibrium. And again, it's because water follows salt. So the only one of the three solutions we've covered that's in fact isotonic is the one that has the same concentrations. So that's the happy place for your cell, not either of these two situations here. If you need some more practice on iso, hypo, hyper, I've given you two pages, 38 and 39. And then we've got one last page to look at, and that one's page 41. How about questions on hypo, hyper, and iso? It's following the salt concentration, which is saltier in the solution. That's why it's leaving. Same concentration. I don't have the same number. That's the clue. It's okay. One more type of passive transport at the top of your page, and this one's called facilitated diffusion. You'll notice that in this case, we have items that are a little too big to squeeze through the phospholipid bilayer. And if they're too big to squeeze through, we have to have an alternate route for them to come in. So this time we use a protein channel, which is simply a type of a protein, integral protein, and it moves larger items like sugars or perhaps polysaccharides through your cell membrane. So this is an example of how it works. Okay, there's your integral protein. It serves as a channel. It just stands open as a doorway and lets big stuff travel through. So what if we want to move against the concentration gradient? Can we use any form of passive transport? If we want to go against the gradient, gotta use active. Okay, so active transport involves three types: solute pumping, endo and exocytosis. So if you want to move things against their gradient, you have to pump them using ATP and a protein pump. So how do you pay the pump to open? Energy, yeah, give it energy, make it open that way, okay? So if you don't have energy to pay the pump doesn't work and things, of course, don't get moved. So with protein pumps, our goal here is to move items against the normal flow and to go from high, or rather from low to high concentration, okay? So when we get into, say, nerve impulse transmission, muscle workings, this is something I'll definitely bring back and reintroduce to you. The last kind, endo and exocytosis, works when we have no other resources available. This is bulk transport, kind of like tractor trailer truck transport. And we put things in big vesicles or vacuoles, and we let the cell literally engulf it, which is what we think of as endocytosis. What if you want to get rid of something? Should you use endo or exocytosis?
Exo.
Exo, yeah. So if in fact you eat bacteria and your cells do this every single day, endocytosis is the process of engulfing or eating the bacteria by using a big vesicle or vacuole. Your body chews them up and spits them out, and that's what you do here by exocytosis. You spit out or erupt the waste products of that bacterium. Okay, so that's kind of, I've left you one blank up there near the top to fill in. Difference between facilitated diffusion and regular. Size is an issue, that's one. And the second issue is we have to use a protein channel. Facilitated diffusion must use a protein channel. If you have any questions, I'm on main campus tomorrow. I'll be here early on Wednesday if you have any questions. You're also welcome to email me if you have anything that you want to go over for Wednesday. All right, good luck studying.